You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. This podcast is about recent developments in the alternative proteins market. I want to explore what's new, what's working, what's not working, whether there's money to be made in the industry, and whether the excitement of the first €250,000 lab-grown burger in 2013 has translated into real business and a real market demand to match the phenomenal success of the plant-based meat market. And joining us to discuss it are Peter Verstrater, co-founder and chief operating officer of Moser Meat.
Good morning.
Dr. Neil Stevens, Wellcome Trust Research Fellow, Brunel University, London.
Hello.
And Dr. Florian Wild, food tech consultant at Food Tech Consulting.
Hello.
Now, just to start off with, Dr. Florian Wild, can you give us an overview of the state of the alternative protein market, maybe with a little bit of background and history, and try and cram that into about 3 minutes? Would that be all right?
Okay, I will give a try. Let's focus on alternative meats. And you are totally right that the market has seen a tremendous change during the last years. And that becomes in particular obvious if you look back some decades. Going maybe back to the 80s, when I was young, let's say meat alternatives, it was really a product for specialists, for vegetarians, vegans that were very, very rare, and you found them somewhere in this bio-oriented markets, the soy chunks, the grain-based patties. So a very, very, very niche product. And let's say in the following years, we came a bit more in contact with meat alternatives, especially in Germany with Asian cuisine that popped up, the restaurants that popped up, and we became familiar with products such as tofu or sometimes with seitan, tempeh.
Ah, yeah, mock duck, I remember.
All this old-style Asian products that are quite different from real meat, to be honest. But they were new to us and to this Asian-style food. And let's say by end of the 1990s, interest in proteins and protein-based food become a bit more severe in Europe. You may remember the Atkins diet. Some people started to eat, meat on as their main dish 3 times a day or something even. And so industry became a bit more aware about protein as a main component of meals. And they started to develop some convenience products. I think especially in the UK, the Quorn range made from mycoprotein. Or we had in the Netherlands the company Valles or Campina that developed a kind of meat based on milk protein, actually. So that were the first, industrial-style products that aimed to replace, to some extent, real meat. And I think then in the following years, we saw quite interest in new technologies in food industry. And the biggest step was that we became available to create fiber-like structures, like in muscle meat, out of plant proteins. So first of all, of course, soy protein that was very known to the industry before, also wheat protein, but also pea and other pulses popped up, and we were able to create something like a muscle meat structure. So first products were chicken-style pieces, especially in the US, but also beef burgers that became now really widely available. And you know the stories from the big US companies that caused something like a hype with a lot of marketing power behind that give the whole market such a boom and such a movement. Today, the market is expanding. We see new ingredients from new raw materials, new plant proteins such from sunflower, rapeseed, algae, insects even, so back to the animal proteins. We see new kind of shapes, of tastes, sensations. The products are very easy to prepare. You can use them as as you are known from the respective meat product. You can grill the burger, you can pan fry the chicken pieces. It's made really easy for the consumer to use such products exactly in the same way as they are used to use them from the respective meat product. So I think that's where we are actually now. Let's see what we will find out during the next half an hour. what will be maybe in the next years the interesting points to watch.
So it's come a long, long way. And I think one of the really exciting moments was when people started talking about lab-grown burgers. Now, Peter, I have vivid memories of the excitement around the unveiling of that first cultured animal cell burger in 2013. Can you tell me a bit about the very basics? I know it's a very complex subject, but how did you create that first burger? And what's now changed in your company? Because it was Moser Meat that produced that first animal cell burger. What's changed in the company and your world, really, over the 7 years since then?
Yeah, Steve. Well, at least we emerged from the lab that created this burger. But indeed, we did this in 2013. Essentially, the process hasn't changed since. We just made it more efficient, more effective, and more applicable, if you like, to the market. But essentially, what we do is we start off with a sample of cells. And these cells come from the muscle tissue of an animal, in our case, a cow. We grow those cells in a bioreactor. We proliferate them, as it's called, until there's a big mass of them. And then when we have enough, we turn those cells into tissue, which is what they're made to do. I mean, this is their role in any organism that has muscle anyway. So what we do is use those properties to do the same and to create muscle tissue from individual cells. And yeah, if you have muscle tissue, you essentially have meat. At least biologically speaking, you have meat. Now that's the easy way to say it. There's a lot of scientific challenges going on behind the screens, and many of them have been solved. Some of them we're still working on, but. You know, essentially, we're doing what the animal does. We're just doing it outside of the animal.
And as I understand it, you have to grow it in a nutrient-rich soup or environment, and that was one of the most expensive parts of it, other than obviously the research around it. Is that still the big issue?
Well, yes and no. I mean, scientifically speaking, this is not a big challenge. Practically speaking, this is a huge challenge. So, essentially, what you need to do is first of all, figure out what these cells need in which stage of their development. And a lot of that is known already. Some of it is not known yet. So that's something we're still working on. But then you need to produce those nutrients at a huge scale and compared to the pharmaceutical prices that are quite common these days, at a crazy low price. And, you know, setting up that supply chain in the future, that's going to be a massive task. Like I said, it's not going to be scientifically extremely intricate. It's just practically going to be a big, big, big task. And
so basically, the technology and the science is in place. It's a way of scaling it up and making it economic.
Well, the technology to sort of identify what the ideal composition of the food of 40 cells is, that is in place. Yes, yes. But there's other aspects of the technology that are still being worked on. Like I said, making the tissue, you need to reach some level of maturity for the tissue to be, let's say, identified as meat by consumers. That's a process in itself. So you need to learn what your cells need to go through all these stages, and that's something we're still working on. And all of our colleagues in the field, there are by now roughly 40 companies doing this, are also working on this.
Okay, now alongside my excitement about the launch of that prototype burger, and I remember it vividly, I also remember a lot of bemusement and even a little horror in the press and amongst the public. Now, Dr. Neil Stevens, I'm particularly excited to have you on the panel because you're a sociologist, and I'm hoping that you can shed light on that crucial carbon-based interface with alternative protein known as the human being. Now, perception and emotion is vitally important when it comes to flogging products like this. Is this where things get tricky for alternative proteins, actually getting them to be consumed?
I mean, it's clearly a key issue, and I think it's quite a diverse one. You mentioned alternative proteins. I think there's different challenges for some of the plant-based proteins compared to the cultured meat type products that we were just talking about. I was lucky enough to be at the press conference in 2013 when the burger we were just talking about was first tasted. And in terms of cultured meat, cell-based meat, whatever you want to call it, it really was a key moment, in my opinion, in setting the frame in the public mind for what this technology could do and who could consume it, why people would want to consume it. And, you know, the framing was very much about potential environmental benefits and a little bit about, you know, consuming food without killing animals or killing significantly less numbers of animals. The extent to which that message would be taken on board was, of course, the big question, or one of the big questions from that event. And I think we've seen a diversity of responses since then. There's certainly enthusiasm within some consumer groups, there's concerns within others, but there was also a lot of movement really within the industry. You know, the 2013 burger was really important in my mind in bringing not just potential publics, potential consumers, but bringing potential investors and other companies into being to pursue this. So quite how publics will respond is a very broad topic. I think there's a lot of diversity and potential answers. There are a set of focus groups and surveys that have been conducted in various countries. I can talk through some of those if you want to. But generally, there's an extent to which, as I say, there's a diversity.
I mean, I remember the phrase Frankenstein food cropped up quite a lot, which I think is a lazy media term, but it affected a lot of people. It chimed with a lot of people's thoughts about what food should be, and I think that's particularly interesting. But has that damaged the market? Is it one of the important things that is yet to be overcome, do you think?
So a lot of the studies into this note that this idea of naturalness is something that some consumers are concerned about in terms of cultured meat in particular. That's perhaps less so in terms of some of like the Beyond Burger and the plant-based meats, where people might be concerned about excessively processed food. But I think there's a distinctiveness to this cell-based meat, cultured meat, cultivated meat, lab-grown meat, whatever you want to call it, which I think, you know, has some reasoning to it. No one has ever made meat in this way before, and it's a really radically different way of producing meat outside of the body of the animal. I mean, that's why it seems to be potentially productive, right? Because it's produced without all of the environmental impact of raising an entire cow, whichever particular animal you're doing. But it is different. And it does, I think, in potentially for some people in quite profound ways, raise questions about how do we relate to the planet? How do we relate to our food? How do we want to engage, you know, in this notion of nature? I mean, of course, in practice, what constitutes natural, what nature is very tricky, very slippery. People have always engaged.
And is that sort of inherently a good thing? What is, you know, the whole concept of natural is relatively bogus, isn't it? You know, everything on the planet is natural. It's all there. You know, the fact that a human created it doesn't mean it's unnatural. It's a natural process. So at some point you have to draw a line and say, this is what I believe to be natural in a good way. And this is a place beyond it. Is that something that everybody does as they shop and buy food?
Well, I don't think you're ever going to resolve the centuries old philosophical debate about what constitutes natural. I think you've got to accept that different people have different notions of what constitutes normal and natural practice for them, and you have to accept that. There is this argument that features within the cultured meat community that less so much about its naturalness, but its normalness could potentially increase, in that as there's clearly a set of people out there who are very enthusiastic to try this, some to consume it on a regular basis. And perhaps as some people start to consume it more regularly, as it's become something that is seen perhaps initially in restaurants, perhaps in other retail environments subsequently, that it might well become more normal looking. But there's a lot to see. There's a long way to go. You know, Peter talked about some of the technical challenges, and clearly some of those are very real. Some of the supply chain issues are very real. And I think the potential politics around consumption is something that at the moment, the surveys tend to suggest there's good progress there, but there's room for that to take on a different form depending on the type of public debate that goes on in the coming decade.
And there are various different sort of versions of what's good and what's bad. Now, Florian, this whole concept of moral relativity, you know, an alternative protein is generally involving a lot of processing of food, and yet the potential environmental benefits, welfare benefits, do they outweigh other issues? Can we say yet that alternative protein has had a genuine change on the world? Can we measure its impact, its positive impact yet?
I think it's obvious from quite a large number of studies that plant-based protein is in general or demands less resources being produced than the animal. But you need to see, you often mention beef as very consuming of resources, but beef itself, it counts only for about 15 to 20% of meat consumption. So chicken, for instance, is much easier to produce, let's say, with less resources. But actually, there's an improvement moving from meat consumption to plant-based protein. Definitely. Not only from the sustainability point of view, you mentioned also animal welfare. For high meat consumption, we have also indications that it's maybe not perfect for maintaining health if you eat too much fat, too much red meat. And I think what's also maybe interesting to see is that plant-based proteins can be more affordable. And today, they have a touch of innovation and they get a new type of food on your plate, but makes it also quite interesting from that point of view.
Mm. But has the market actually had an impact? Is there anything measurable yet? Because a lot of the claims that are made about alternative protein, about its environmental benefits, are quite ambitious. Have we seen actual change potentially in emissions levels, in farming, in energy use, land use, water use? Is anything measurable yet? Do you know?
Yeah, there are the studies that measure all these emissions and resource consumptions, land use, use of water per kilogram of digestible protein, etc. So you have a clear indication that you have a benefit. Still, if you compare the total consumption of meat alternatives with the meat market, it's still a relatively small market, maybe 2-3% for the moment. Compared to meat, but if you look to the dairy segment, where you replaced now quite a bigger share of milk and milk products with respective plant-based products and with a big variety, you have oat-based milk, you have soy-based, pea-based, almond-based. Not all of them are the same, let's say, in resources and production. But clearly they replace the animal-based product, and by that way they can contribute to reduce the carbon footprint, etc.
Yeah. Okay, now, Peter, let's just bring this back to the context of the entire animal protein world. Where does your cell-grown meat sit as part of the alternative protein sort of landscape? Because a lot of the plant-based products have got to market a lot more quickly. But you've had two rounds of finance recently, so there must be still a lot of enthusiasm for your product. What would be your selling point to show that it's different from what's already in the market and being very successful?
Yeah, that's a very good point, a very good question. Because if you look at this from a rational point of view, we don't really need to do this. I mean, we can be perfectly fine with a plant-based diet, as many consumers already show day to day. We don't really need to consume all that meat that we're consuming. But at the same time, we can't really help it because we can afford it, and it's so yummy. I mean, so you know, we're just suckers, and we can't help eating meat, apart from a few people who somehow found the strength to not do it anyway. So what we, and by we I mean the cultured meat field or the cell-based meat field or whatever you call it, what we build on is this craving for meat. And what we're aiming at is giving people an alternative to meat, and the only one that really will work long-term for the masses of people, which is meat. So the only thing that, despite the fact, and I applaud it personally, that the plant-based field is getting so much attention recently, and then so much money is going towards it, and there's so much developments going on. That's great. And as you just heard, the market share is still quite small, but it will grow significantly in the future. But it will not tempt Joe Meat to move away from his hamburgers or frankfurters and put something plant-based on the barbecue. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. For that, you need meat. So the only real alternative to meat, from our point of view, is meat. And we're sort of, giving people an alternative to their addiction.
And but your particular product, the idea of cell-grown meat in context of all the other alternative proteins, what will be your selling point for cell-grown rather than an Impossible Burger?
It ticks a lot of boxes, but we do this because of the environmental impact of traditional meat, and because of the potential reduction of that impact by producing meat this way. There's always there's also the animal welfare thing, of course. I mean, we don't like that we need to kill animals for meat consumption. We're not freaks, but my company is not the founders of my company are not vegans or vegetarians. Actually, I come from the meat industry. That's where my professional background is. So our main reason to do this is the environmental impact of traditional meat, and having a technology that can eradicate that sort of while still giving the proper answer to that craving of people for meat.
Okay. Now, the demand for meat alternatives was sort of really considered to come from consumer concerns about animal welfare. I think that's the first issue. You know, it was very much a vegetarian point. But now it seems that there's more of a triumvirate of concerns. There's animal welfare, environmental sustainability, and health as well. Sort of perceptions of what's healthy. Now, Neil, what do you think is fueling market demand and development most from a consumer perspective?
So my work focuses on cultured meat. Primarily. So I can't really answer that question authoritatively in terms of plant-based meat. I think you'd have to say that market demand is still, I mean, there isn't a market, there aren't products available to buy. So you can't meaningfully talk about market demand for cultured meat right now. There's certainly interest. One of the companies called Mission Barns over the summer announced that they were going to allow a number of people, perhaps around 50 to 100, to try their product for free. And they very quickly saw those opportunities were taken up. But the market is global, potentially global, and potentially diverse. We've already listed.
And what's the selling point of cultured meat?
Oh, sure.
Above,
I mean, there's a diversity
above and beyond.
Peter's already mentioned them. But one of the core ones is this idea that meat as we produce it right now is environmentally challenging in terms of land use, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, in terms of water use. And there's various studies out there that try to hypothesize what a scaled up system would look like for cultured meat and how much energy it may or may not use. These are hypothetical issues. It certainly looks clear like it would use less land. Different studies come up with different figures for energy use, for example. There's also, I think you're right to say that early on there was a stronger voice around a sort of a vegan movement towards this, although cultured meat itself isn't typically considered to be vegan because you do at least need a cell. At some point, you need at least one cell, maybe more.
So just thinking about the packaging, can you say it's vegetarian?
Well, that would be up for the regulatory authorities.
What does everyone here think?
But it's also up to, I think, the companies in terms of whether they want it to be thought of as vegetarian. I mean, I've always
stressed... That's true, actually. I mean, the cultured meat issue, it sort of makes it sound more meaty, doesn't it? To say it's cultured rather than plant-based. And I wonder if that is a selling point.
Well, you know, for a lot of people, there's a big debate within the community in terms of this kind of labeling that you're talking about, but also just amongst the community themselves of what you call it, what word you cultured meat, cell-based meat, all of these. But the idea that meat has been in the name has been consistent. And there are people that tell you, you know, eventually we will just call it meat because that's exactly what it is. Now, I mean, I think that's a very particularly sort of asserted conceptualization of how we should understand it. And I think it's unlikely, at least initially, that the regulators will allow it to be called just meat without some kind of added term to signify that it's made with a radically different process. And I've always, a key thing that I've been trying to explore over the last 10 years or longer that I've been looking at this is these shifting framings of what it is and how this novel technology, this novel foodstuff comes into being, how it's framed politically. And it ties in exactly to the issue, well, in part ties into the issue that you're raising about why people want to buy into this. It's why I started talking about the burger earlier, as well as you, of course, talked about the burger, that it offered a frame, if you think, to potential consumers, to the viewing public of the press conference. It offered a type of person that you could want to be, someone who's concerned about the environment, but perhaps doesn't want to reposition their eating into a plant-based or a chickpea and, you know, vegetable protein-based diet. It was a very positive image of an easy social change where technology is proving very helpful. Going back to something we were saying earlier, you know, for some, this kind of techno solution and the highly technological formats, it is a problem for them. It's something that people are less comfortable about. And the original question was, why would people be attracted to it? You know, there's a discussion.
I'm always reminded of that phrase that Michael Pollan came up with, which was never eat anything that your grandmother didn't know, or words to that effect. And I've always thought, well, somebody didn't know the potato to begin with, but it's pretty damn important. You know, the potato at some point was a foreign import that had never been seen before, and that those things are relatively bogus. Now, Florian, I'd just like to ask you a slightly tangential question, because obviously you're a food tech consultant. Now, I'm very interested in this idea. How is the background science and technology evolving to support sort of innovation and the mainstreaming of new products? And are there enough people coming into the industry to sustain this continuing development? Because it's a vast requirement, isn't it? And certainly in the UK, we're searching for hundreds of thousands of new, you know, technologists and engineers and scientists to enter the food industry, and it's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, let's say addressing a bit the topic Neil mentioned before. You see, in the food industry, it's already a trend for a couple of years or even a decade that you try in general to go back to a more natural, more clean label food product. So actually ingredients your grandmother would know or at least could pronounce. So that's a general trend, and I think that's totally fine. That's also something we should consider and keep in mind when it comes to plant-based meat. It's always from a technological point of view, it's a bit the challenge. Let's say, how much do you need to process the raw material? Let's say, to remove, for instance, all the non-protein components from a seed, because they change the nutritional profile from meat, that is basically protein. But also to remove, let's say, flavor components from the seed, that you have quite a neutral base, and that you can flavor afterwards with a meat flavor, let's say, chicken, beef, or whatever. Finally, to end up with a product that's very close to the real meat product. It's really an imitate.
Actually, can I just ask you a quick question about that, actually? Which is the most challenging part of the process? Is it the texture or is it the taste?
It's actually both. for me, it's more of a texture, let's say. And for flavor, we have big progress from the international flavor houses that really work on the flavor development, also on natural flavors. Consumers, it seems that they are more attracted by products that are extremely similar to the meat product. Using different raw materials, it offers you a wide spectrum of new opportunities to produce new tastes, products that are really new and are not that close to the meat product, but still have this fibrous texture and this juicy bite. And then it's an interesting situation. How close do you need to be to meat, and what kind of freedom do you have?
But the technology and the understanding and the science involved in it is puts an enormous strain on an industry that in some areas is struggling to recruit. I mean, are there actually enough people to support the industry and for continuing development?
I think so. If you have a look to the situation at universities and education research centers, food technology is well attended and there's a lot of interest in, even more than 1 or 2 decades ago. Mm. So I think from an academic point of view, it seems to be attractive, definitely. What's a kind of problem for the food industry is a bit, and that's going from bakeries, butchers, to really the food industry and gastronomy as well, is that it's in general a business with relatively low wages and often not very attractive working conditions. The baker that starts very early in the morning, and that's maybe more the challenging thing for let's say educated workers.
Whereas Peter wanders into the office at about 10:30 normally, is that right, Peter?
10-ish, 11-ish, yeah, that's about right.
Now, Peter, back in 2013, one beef burger, one cultured meat burger, cost. The headline was that it cost €250,000. How close are we to an affordable cultured meat burger now, and what does the timeline look like? And I know, you know, this might be sort of putting your finger in the air and having a guess, but it's interesting to discuss it, I think.
Yeah, it is a little bit putting your finger in the air, indeed. For sure, those first burgers, we actually made a few, but they were pricey, so it was a tall order. But what you have to distinguish here is developing the technology that proves it will be cheap at some point and actually making it cheap. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this because there's a difference between the two. The proof of scalability, both technical but also from this point of view, so from the point of view of being able to produce this meat cheap at some point in the future, that's going to come relatively soon. I mean, a lot of people, including ourselves, are working on, let's say, different approaches to culture media. Making cheaper growth media, making the process itself more efficient, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's all good. And that's all advancing pretty well. And I expect within the next couple of years, at some point, there will be, let's say, proof beyond reasonable doubt that indeed this is going to work at scale in the future. Mm. But then actually making it cheap, physically making it cheap, that requires what, like I said earlier, that requires for instance, a supply chain of food that, you know, that's massive. If you do the math and you look at the size of the meat business today and you want to replace just a tiny bit of that with cultured meat, and you look at the food supply chain you need to feed the cells that are required to make that meat, it's simply huge and it simply doesn't exist today. So essentially what we need to do is go to the point where we prove that it will be a technology for the future. I think we're close to that point. Once that happens, you will see a lot of money, a lot of resources pouring in to make that happen. But to come back to your initial question, how long is that going to take? I think it's going to be closer to 10 than to 5 years before you see it in the supermarket.
And is your company, is Moza Meat really in the business of developing the technology and owning technology and process and understanding and research rather than pumping out 5 million burgers?
It's a bit of both, actually. I mean, there's there's so much value associated with these products that it's almost impossible not to build a brand around it. And a meat brand, let alone a global meat brand, these are scarce these days. Meat, I mean, most meat is sold by supermarkets under their private labels or private brands.
Yeah.
And it just makes a lot of sense to build a brand around this technology. So we will do that. But on the other hand, if you do this to create a change, you want to do it fast, and you simply cannot conquer the world on your own. So you also have to do this in parallel and sort of plant the technology on as many places on this planet as you can once you have it figured out, and do it in parallel.
It's an interesting concept that you're looking so far ahead before you're even getting to market. Does that worry you? Does it keep you awake at night?
Well, I wouldn't say it keeps you awake at night, but first of all, if you have to spend serious money in this development, and it's private money, then people require you to think ahead. Mm. That's simply the way it is. So you need to have some sort of vision, but you also need to have imagination. So you need to imagine that this is going to happen at some point, despite the fact that there are all sorts of barriers today that people might think are critical. Mm. I guess there are similarities between this and like the electric car industry, for instance, where it's also easy, like 10 years ago, to mock the Prius. But it's much harder to realize that it might be a crappy car, but it's not about the car at this moment in time. Mm. It's about what it stirs up. It's about what it starts.
And what it represents. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Now, a question for all three of you, really, who I don't know who would like to answer this most, but I wonder, what are the biggest challenges in mainstreaming cultured meat? Whether is it regulatory, is it technological, commercial, is it sheer mountains of cash? What are the biggest hurdles to overcome? Neil, do you think it's people? Do you think it's perception?
Well, clearly it's all of these things. I mean, there are... Right now, no one can market cultured meat because there isn't a regulatory body who has a approved and finalized regulatory process to confirm that it's safe, suitable, and well labeled. Mm. But I anticipate that's a bureaucratic issue. There's an extent to which the regulators are dealing with uncertainties about what the eventual process will look like, but that seems to me to be resolvable. Peter, of course, has talked about some of the technical challenges involved in first proving, but then developing a supply chain that makes it inexpensive. Certainly, if the companies continue to pursue the line that they want to sell it based on the fact that it's environmentally better, then there's a similar set of technical challenges about ensuring that it's done in the most energy efficient way, or at least an energy efficient way, and in terms of greenhouse gases and things like that. And there's also, it depends a little on the route to market. It depends what you think the end product is. So there's massive differences between producing sausages, for example, and producing steaks. And we're also seeing people talk more about blended products, which is where actually you would blur the plant-based cultured meat boundary and have something that had a proportion of both. And quite which proportion you would have, you know, depends on what you think is required for taste. But it seems highly likely, from everything that we've been talking about, that the plant-based products are much cheaper in terms of volume than the cultured meat. So you would probably want to have, enough cultured meat to get the taste advantages that you wanted. Mm. I've also felt for some time that at one point we're likely to see some kind of professionalized, organized, antagonistic movement towards cultured meat, a group of people who do not support this technology and make some kind of an attempt to get in the way. Now, there's an extent to which we've already seen something like that from the United States Cattlemen's Association, who I'm not sure we need to go into detail about all of that, but there, over the previous years, there's been an ongoing debate, which has actually resulted in, from where I'm standing, it looks to me like it's resulted in the American regulatory practice coming into being a little bit quicker than it may otherwise have done. Exactly what form that will take, we don't yet know. But I think there are possibilities that the debate, the terms of the public debate might shift, and that could bring new challenges. There's a paper published very recently looking at newspaper reporting in the US and the UK about cultured meat, and it demonstrates that overwhelmingly the people who are interviewed in these newspaper articles and the people whose press releases are essentially being reproduced are people within the cultured meat industry and the community, people from the startups, some university-based researchers who are involved, and also from a number of third sector groups. So the media story is being played out to a certain extent in accordance with the type of narrative that people who support this want to see being discussed.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it will definitely happen, but I think there is a possibility as the technology develops further that you might see other types of voices changing that narrative. And how the cultured meat community responds to that and how successfully they respond to that is something that we would have to wait and see.
Yeah, let's
but,
not.
But I think when margarine was
first brought out and marketed, the dairy industry in the US forced them to make it pink in order to make it not seem like butter. Sorry, I butted in, but.
Yeah, well, it's an example. This might come from the existing meat industry. I often wonder if there might be some people, for example, within the environmental movement who question whether this is the very best way to address climate change. You see a lot more buy-in from the vegan movement than you do from the environmental movement. The environmental movement has some people that are very keen about this, but other people who are much more quiet about it and sometimes less convinced. So exactly what that evolving debate will look like, when it will happen, and what difference it will make to the tone of the debate at the moment and the challenges that that brings in terms of attracting commercial support, but also attracting potential consumers is I think something that's a wait and see story at the moment.
It's a really interesting,
but it's worth being aware of that possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I think we should probably bring this to a close now, because we could chat about this forever. So I've got one question to ask all of you, and it's a very simple but a complex one at the same time. If you had 10 million quid, let's make this sterling, which is probably about €2 in the current climate. let's say £10 million to invest in any aspect of alternative protein, whether it's a product, a base protein, a technological process, people, what would you invest in? And you can't choose your own company or yourself. So Florian, £10 million to invest in some aspect of alternative protein, where would you put your money?
I would actually stick to plant proteins, likely more on the ingredient side. Let's say processing the raw material, the seeds, to functional proteins that you can then further transfer to plant meat or other plant-based foodstuff.
And is that in the technology or in the ownership of seed types? What do you think?
Let's say manufacturing, production, and there's still a good opportunity for research and development to find.
But basically, you build a factory. Okay, fair enough. And Peter, you're not allowed to invest in your own company. Where would you put £10 million in some aspect of alternative protein?
If I can loosely interpret that as not being able to invest in cultured meat at all.
I think you could. But okay.
Well, then I would just create maybe some discussion. I would probably invest it in producing fat, cultured fat, and look at merging the properties of that fat with the advancing plant-based technologies, and then see if we can get the best of both worlds by doing so. A lot of the taste from meat and a lot of what lacks in plant-based products is actually in the fat. Mm. So it might be interesting to merge the two and have a cheap and established technology base on one hand, but add whatever triggers our brain to think it's meat on the other hand.
Yeah, okay. So Peter's chosen £10 million worth of fat. Neil, where would you put your £10 million?
Well, you know, I'm an academic social scientist, so I'm going to kind of stick to form. And I would say I would like to spend the money on having a really rich, diverse public policy dialogue about food, about alternative proteins, about some of the uncertainties and how to deal with uncertainties around what it is that we choose to make as food and how we choose to consume that. In the UK, there's a real diversity of stakeholders in the food sector. I don't have to say that. But actually, there aren't that many public accounts of what a great many of them think about, especially cultured meat and some of the other technologies that are available as well. So I would like to see a really kind of democratically accountable, open, fair, honest dialogue about how we eat today and how we want to eat in the future.
Fantastic. Okay. Just as you mentioned the word stakeholder, I think I'm put my £10 million into a brand called Stakeholder. There we go. That was supposed to be funny, but there you go. And now you've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Peter Verstrate, Dr. Neil Stevens, and Dr. Florian Wild. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And you also listened to me, Stephen Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.